To Open Minds Radio. This is your host Alejandro Rojas, and I am all by myself this week. Jason is on vacation. Maureen, I think I already told you, she's off in Belize having an incredible adventure out there, scuba diving and island hopping and having fun. So I'm just all by myself. So I'll be doing the show on my own today. Talking about, to begin with, I guess our guest for the show is Tom Reed. So some of you may be familiar with his case. Him and his brother had some amazing experiences when they were kids in the 60s. And they have strange memories similar to, the alien abduction scenarios. But at least Tom is not quite sure what happened to him. He's not so sure, it's extraterrestrials or otherwise. I guess in one of those incidents, he feels it probably is. But really interesting stuff. And we're going to talk to him to get more details about those events that happened in the 60s. And then a more recent event that happened to his brother. And also the UN actually, we've talked about this with Lee Spiegel and Antonio Huneas and others about how in the 70s the UN visited the UFO subject prompted by the president of Grenada, Sir Eric Gary, and they kind of passed this decision where, they wanted to collect UFO info, but it really didn't go anywhere. But in the 90s, there was a meeting that was prompted by a parapsychologist at the UN. And so there was more discussion about UFOs, and the Reed case was one of those that they talked about, or at least some of the UFO sightings related to, or that they had seen in the 60s. So we'll talk to him about that, and really interesting stuff. So I've met Thomas Reed, and he's a really cool guy, and I've been excited to talk to him for a while, and it has taken a while for us to arrange this, but it's well worth the wait. So we'll talk to him in a minute. But before that, I'm going to do UFO news all by myself since Jason's gone. But last week was kind of a busy week, actually, I think. It started off, and some of you probably had seen this, with a lot of to-do in the media about these Mars photos. And actually, they were posted by a ufologist, this Mars photo where it looks like there's a light off in the distance. This is Chris Mooring from UFO Sightings Daily, and he felt that this was a light, possibly from some underground extraterrestrial base. But scientists in NASA have come back and said, well, probably not. That it's probably either a cosmic ray that hit the image sensor in one of the cameras in the rover causing this light, or possibly a light leak in the camera, meaning there is light coming in through the housing when the light hits it just right, or a rock out in the distance that is reflecting light. And the latter actually is less likely, because one of the things that they've been able to discover or release is that this picture is from a camera that is actually a stereo camera. So there are two cameras that take pictures at the exact same time. And actually one of these cameras got the light and the other didn't, which shows it's most likely something to do with that right-hand camera as opposed to an actual light off in the distance. But there is no 100% consensus on what happened there, but that made a lot of news, and you can see that at the website. This is kind of cool. Here's a cool story that I thought was a lot of fun. And this is this, I called him a beef jerky mogul, but actually it's kind of the neat story of this gentleman from Argentina who first started doing beef jerky out in selling beef jerky in near Area 51. And he actually was a plumber, no, an electrician, but he decided to do this on the side, and it did really well. He said he sold $800 in his first day. Well, the cops kind of came and harassed him and asked him if he had permits, and he didn't, so he had to move on. But they also asked him about his green card, and being from Argentina, he does have a green card. And funny thing, he looked at his green card, and it said resident alien. And because his jerky business had done so well, he decided to call his business Alien Fresh Jerky. And some of you from California are probably familiar with it, because his new location was in a town called Baker, which is about halfway from LA to Las Vegas. And I don't know if you're like me, Arizona is about the same distance from Vegas as LA. I think maybe LA is a little closer, so I go to Vegas a lot, you know, driving out there to go have fun for a weekend. And, of course, people in L.A. do that a lot. And so a lot of them will see this Alien Fresh Jerky, because it started off with kind of a small place, but he's done extremely well at selling this beef jerky. His sign is this big alien face, and he's kind of gone crazy with this alien theme, where he has UFOs outside of his building. He has aliens climbing all over. He has a huge building now with tons of products that he sells right off the road there. And so it's a really popular place, and he's decided to build a big UFO hotel. So a hotel that looks like a giant mothership. And this guy wants to do something like, you know, you would see at an amusement park or something, something very elaborate. So it's kind of cool. And he's no joke here. It's not like he's just starting this project. He's actually gone a long way to secure the ground, to secure funds. He's gotten investments to cover the $30 million it's going to take this whole thing. And now he's got approval from the local, from the city. So he's going to do this. He's going to be breaking ground really soon here to build this thing. And it should be done in the next couple of years. So Californians, or those going to from Las Vegas to California, keep an eye out for that. And when this thing gets up, I'm definitely going to have to take a trip out there and check it out. It looks really cool. He's going to do tours. He's going to have an alien themed. He's going to change his building to look like a UFO, the current building, and he's going to have all the buildings on the land look like space stations or UFO themed. So it's going to be really cool roadside attraction. However, if you want to stay at this hotel, it's not going to be cheap, he says. He says it's going to be a high-end hotel that's going to cater to high-end clientele. But for those of us that are not necessarily able to afford high-end, we'll be able to pay for a tour and get a tour around the facility. So kind of something to look forward to. I think that's really cool personally. It's always fun to have something to look forward to that's UFO-related or UFO-oriented. Now, a genuine mystery. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the stories that the media covers, we're able to figure out what it is, or like the Mars story, it points to something more mundane rather than something mysterious. However, there was a story last week about these loud explosions they're hearing in a town called Highgate, which is actually a suburb in North London, and it's an expensive suburb, so there are some celebrities that live there. But for a little over a year, residents have been reporting these explosions. Just the other day one happened, a week ago from today, and the resident said it sounded like a gas explosion. People say that these explosions rock their homes. Their homes will actually shake. However, no one has been able to figure out what it is. Even the local government there, the borough, what it's called, which is kind of a county council, has been looking into it. They've investigated the local electric substation, and that's not it. They've looked into the underground, you know, their underground tube system there where they kind of their underground railway, and that isn't it. No construction in the area that it's due to, so they're at a loss. And there's been a lot of stories about this recently in a paper called The Hill and Ham. And so what The Hill and Ham did was they ran a poll a couple weeks ago to ask people, well, what do you think it is? And among the dozen or so things that they listed, they also included UFOs. So people voted, and UFOs, you know, was later on because it was kind of, I think, I don't know if they were serious about that submission there or possibility that they opened to their readers. But in this reader's poll, actually it was tied as to what the readers thought were responsible for these explosions. It was either a faulty substation or UFOs, people felt. And, of course, faulty substation had been ruled out, so possibly the council will look into the UFO possibility. But that was kind of interesting that the city folk there had listed that as one of the main possibilities. And still, it's a genuine mystery as to what the heck is making these loud noises that are really annoying residents. In fact, one lady who works for a TV station locally, she's been doing some investigations, and on our story I posted a picture of her doing her own investigation with a camera and a microphone. She says that this thing, you know, is so loud it usually happens between 10 p.m. and midnight. And that's what the resident on Monday had said, that it was 10 p.m. when it happened. But it keeps her 8-year-old son up, and he's kind of getting annoyed, and others are getting annoyed about what the heck is going on here. So some really interesting stories. I guess the last one maybe I'll mention is this. The MUFON website put up a UFO picture. They're featuring UFO pictures weekly. They have a UFOs weekly kind of thing. But it looks like, and you know, I'm a big fan of MUFON, and there was an investigation done, and they kind of concluded that as an unknown. But even the witness, it seems, when I looked at the witness report, it said it looks like there's a plane to the upper right of the object, and sure enough, it does. And it looks like actually it's a big banner, one of those airplane banners. I don't know if you all have them where you live, but here in Phoenix, Geico is flying around these big airplane banners quite often, and I see those when I'm coming into town, and that's really what this looks like. So I put up a picture of the banner, and or a known banner, and you can take a look, but I think that's what it is, unfortunately. So, you know, even though some things get figured out, there are some genuine mysteries out there, like the explosion. So, of course, go to openminds.tv to read more about all of this. However, without further ado, let's get into our interview and talk to Mr. Tom Reed. Okay, I am so excited to have on the phone with me Tom Reed, and he's going to share with us his incredible experience. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I think it seems like every year that goes by that more and more people are starting to, get a better handle or feel for what our case has to offer. And with that said, I certainly appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no problem. I'm glad we can finally make some time. Been meaning to talk to you for a long time. But, yeah, you keep getting more and more attention, including, which I thought was pretty neat, a big article, what was it, just last month in the Indianapolis Monthly?
Yeah, that really came out of nowhere. Not to take up too much time on it, but I was filming with Lori Wagner and Yvonne Smith, and I was actually with one of the owners of the Black Beauty, the million-dollar meteor that came from Mars, apparently.
Oh, wow.
And we were doing a little documentary over there, and Evan West, who is the chief editor, happened to stop by and speak with us, and he was going to do a little piece on us, and it turned out to be 9 pages with 2 pages of intro. So, and it was a mainstream magazine, and what surprised me is that the 2 or 3 days that he hung with us, you never know what they're going to write. You know, you're always fingers crossed, and he really did his homework and looked into things and validated, and I couldn't really be happier with a mainstream article. I mean, I was absolutely, I was impressed. I really was. They did a very nice job with it.
Yeah, that's great. And at least to me, and we'll see what you think, it seems like a lot of media sources are feeling a less, like they have to make things tongue-in-cheek. It feels like they're feeling more and more comfortable being serious about this topic.
I think your delivery, or certainly in my delivery and what I try to do, and I'm very grounded about my approach to this, I try to keep things very very simple and factual. And I think with that, it's helped us with, like you said earlier, alluded to the fact that, you know, our cases does seem to be getting into mainstream more and more. And I think it's because I hold back a lot, to be honest with you, and just try to go with the tangible. And I think they're starting to respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start getting into the case, and I know there's a lot to it, so there's certainly some points that I want to make sure and cover to demonstrate the credibility of the case, but let's begin with, I guess this all started for you and your brother in the 60s, is that correct?
Yes, it was. 66, my mother had quite a horse farm. We had about 80 acres of property, and over a five-year period, there were 3 days, basically, or 3 evenings or nights, that we had been face-to-face with something extraordinary. And with that said, you know, there has been a lot of question or, you know, years of this and years of that. We've only had a handful of accounts. And that's something I think is important to make everyone aware of, too. We had 3 nights or days where seen and been involved with crafts. And they weren't just isolated to us. There were about, I've been told, 30 to 40, somewhere in there, that gave testimony from a country club called Egremont Country Club, which was in, or Jug and Resort. It had a name, the restaurant was Jug and Resort. And there were a lot of pillars in the community who gave testimony way back, and I believe that was 60, I think that was 69. Not, it was 66, but I have the paperwork here. But because there was so much testimony given, and that it's actually J. Allen Hynek actually gave that sighting, with that placed this craft over our property, performing acrobatical movements, is how you'll see it online worded that way, and send it over our property. And with that said, a radio station by the name of the call letters was WSBS, actually ran a piece on the radio about it. So that's how this really got its roots, I guess, or validated way back when, was through with those witnesses of WSBS radio, and of course our testimony.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that you saw? You were with your brother when you first saw this thing?
Yeah, what really happened, there were three days that we remember vividly. And I'll go back, 1967 was one that I think has gotten the most attention, because that's the one that Alien Mysteries did, and so on and so forth. My brother and I were in our rooms. We were talking. We had bunk beds. He had a top bunk, I had the bottom. And at the time, we had a relative staying with us from Hollis, Queens. And so my grandmother, Marion, who was involved with us later on, actually was bunking with my mother in the master bedroom. And so this was not the first time we had an experience, but it was probably the one that really shook us, you know, aside from 69 the most. And what we saw and what we felt was, and we've used this reference, when there's a full moon, you can kind of stay out later. You've got this inner energy. There is something that your body picks up on. You can't explain it. It's not an anxiety. It's not a paranoia. There's just a lift. There's something about going out on a full moon. I think we all can relate to that. That's why I'm using it as a simile. You take that and you times it 3 or 4 times, and that's kind of what it was like. We just felt alive. There was something going on in this room. And while we were talking, it seemed to become more heavier, and there was what I reflect on now as being an electromagnetic field, I think, because that's what was found on our vehicles later on. So I'm only assuming that that's what it was that we were picking up on. But everything just got very, went from a powerful lift, almost a dead calm with some paranoia in it. And we all of a sudden, we just got scared. We were like, both of us. We just got quiet. My brother was in a, like, sitting up in his top bunk in, like, the, in, like, Indian style in the corner, and I was just, like, still. I didn't want to move because I felt I was being watched type of thing. You know, you had that feeling. And there was a crack in the doorway, and we were looking at that in the closet. Next we realized, you know, that this was becoming really unsettling, and there were some flashes of light. So my mother actually had come into the room, and we used to keep the window open because we didn't have air conditioning back then. And so she shuts the window and says, I think it's going to storm, but I think it's going to pass because I don't hear any thunder. And when she left and that window was closed, we were kind of drawn to the window, I guess, because she had just closed it. And in the distance, you could see this little ring of light. It looked like a hula hoop. And when I say that, it wasn't as if it was a craft or something. It couldn't have been much bigger than a hula hoop itself. And outside that window, there was a stream, a brook. And on the other side of that brook, there was just an open, another pasture like ours. So there was nothing there. And then I'm staring at it. My brother sees it. So for me to get a better look at it, I had hung my head off the side of the bed. And I was looking at it from the side of the bed and staring at it. And the way my brother words it, it just looked like this light fired into the room. I felt as if I was just taken and stood up and inverted and hit in a way that I can only describe like an ocean wave with the white wash, and then I felt inverted. I wasn't in the room anymore. And I know how that sounds, but that's what happened. And my brother ran down the steps. He tried to wake my mother after some trouble getting her awake. She ran to go to our room to see what Matthew was upset about. And then it was as if, my mother words it, as if it sounded like a series of doors slamming all at once. And then she couldn't find Matthew. And so after searching the property, we had floodlights. my mother didn't know what to do anymore. We were pretty much alone on the road. My grandmother went on the front screen porch, turned on the lights. We had floods around the barn. And there was actually a phone on a telephone pole out near the stable. And he searched the property for us. And Alien Mysteries did a pretty good piece on that. That's why I'm sharing this part of it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so she found us an hour or so later, and I was between the house and the stable, and I was looking at my younger brother, and they mentioned that I looked very placid and pale and that kind of thing, but I still remember seeing him pretty well. And my mother jumped off the horse, grabbed my younger brother, grabbed me, scooped us up, brought us into the house. She gave us aspirin, wiped us down with, I still remember it, wiped us down with wet towels and had given us juice and so on, and put us to bed in the living room, you know, on the sofas, and spent the night with us downstairs. What my brother and I remember from that, we remember a rock that we had never seen before. I was not allowed to ride my horse up there. So this path or field that we were at, I found only, I'm going to say maybe a week or so later, because I'm sure it wasn't too much longer, that my mother was out saddling up my horse. And I took Thunder up to the top where I believe this had happened, and I ducked my head under the mane and broke through the tree line, and there was this rock. It was like a boulder. It was probably 15 feet high, 12 feet high maybe, and maybe 15 feet long, and I had never seen it before, that memory that I had of that night with my brother. And so I went a little further down this path, which was up on a little bit of a ledge, a lip, and to the right was this tree that looked like a wishbone, or I remember it being a wishbone. It could have a broken limb of some sort, but I referenced it as a wishbone. And just past that was this big open area, and I knew as soon as I saw it, you know, the chills up your arms, and bang, that is where this craft was. And to give you an idea of what it looked like, I'm going to guess. I know I was younger, so I'm very careful to describe it as big as it was, but I believe it was about 15 feet high, maybe bigger. It was probably, you know, 50 to 60 feet round. It was very good size, and it did not look shiny like so many reference. It wasn't that polished chrome look. And I'm sure you talked to a lot of people, so I'm going to really try to describe this to you and see if this jogs your mind with any other conversations you might have had. But
mm-hmm.
It looked almost pewter, with like a tarnished bronze gold running over it, almost like it was to tone, or maybe just like someone took a blowtorch to it, something along those lines, and it had lines in it. It wasn't a smooth top. It had some lines coming from the top down to the bottom. I can't remember them exactly, but it was not a smooth surface. And it had a lip around it that reminded me very much of a tire tube, like maybe a 10-speed or a mountain bike tire around the outside that was, you know, made of the same material, but it had a very rounded lip around it. And then maybe they like, it looked like the top third of a ball. It was very simple in design. I did not see any windows. I did not see any landing gear. I saw this rounded tube-like piece around the outside of it, and it looked very in rough shape, really. You know, I'll be honest with you. It wasn't this shiny, pretty thing. It looked like it was almost dull. But it was at night when I saw it, but there was enough light that you could see it clear enough, and that's what it looked like. And it was just sitting flat on the ground. I told my mother when I first saw it that it just looked like a huge turtle shell. You know, I've had a lot of references when I was younger, but if you look, picture a tarnished bronze turtle shell, and to some degree, that's what it looked like.
Wow, interesting. So, yeah, kind of a. Now, is that similar to what other people reported?
Others just said a vessel or disc-shaped object that was performing acrobatical movements unknown to the U.S. Air Force, apparently, and descended over the property of.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a sighting from, I think it was Hampton or Hamden, Massachusetts, one of the two, another time, that was also given a rating, and that was only about 30 miles from our home too. So there were a lot of sightings there, and as a matter of fact, the chamber and the and WSBS radio actually had so many calls, they actually ran a little broadcast on it, a little radio broadcast, and after that, a lot of people were talking about it. Several children in school had drawn sketches of what they saw or what their parents had seen for, you know, whatever it was. They had sketched this craft and so on. And I walked into the classroom the first time I saw this, and they were all lined up on the bottom underneath the chalkboard, these sketches from these children. And the teacher had come up to me and asked me to take my seat. And I had looked right in the eye and said, they're not green and they're not from Mars. And she asked me how I knew that. Yeah, how do you know that, Tommy? You know, and I told her who I was and so on. And of course, it made for a long day. But when you combine that with the fact that my mother owned a Village Green restaurant at 113 Main Street in Sheffield, a lot of people would come in there for breakfast. And the restaurant was almost, I'm going to guess, maybe 500 yards from the entrance of the school. So a lot of the kids used to go to breakfast there or meet their parents there after school was over. It seemed to be like a local little hangout. And a lot of the family members and that breakfast club would get together and talk. And, of course, there were some that were very supportive, and there were some that made my mother's life miserable.
Mm-hmm. So now, and this was just, was this the first incident or then the second?
Yeah, the first was more like the first was kind of vague. I mean, it was almost like the feeling was the same. There was always that weird environmental change that came around the property. You know, things would go silent. You know, you wouldn't hear the crickets or katydids or birds or anything, and then all of a sudden something would erupt, and it would be there'd be a change, I pretty much am sold on the fact that it has to do with ELF. I could be wrong, but that's my feeling on it. And what my brother and I saw at that time that was really only different than the second incident we had was that there was images displayed. I remember seeing what looked like a willow tree and a body of water and this screen that went from like 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And I remember it... I can still see it, even with my eyes open, I can still see it. I mean, it was huge. It was probably, 10 feet high and just wrapped around this whole area that it was just massive, and there was this gold willow tree, and it was blowing, and the branches are moving, and the water is blue, and I'm just staring at this thing, and I have no idea to this day what the significance was. I mean, I've researched willow trees. You know, the aspirin comes from the willow tree. There are some health benefits. There's some talk about it, but I have no idea why I was shown that. And my mother, believe it or not, sometime later had planted a willow tree around the horse's watering hole. And she had moved our room after this had happened. She actually closed it off, and my brother and I had taken the master, and she had moved over to the room where our friend was staying that had been staying with us from Hollis, Queens. And so our room was blocked off, and we weren't allowed to go back in there, as if that was she didn't want us in there. I went to bed, and I could see this willow tree that she had planted out that master bedroom window, which was between the house and the stable. It had an effect on me even then, because my mother actually came in a second time one night to give me a kiss goodnight, and I lunged up with a fork, and I actually caught her in the the eyebrow area of her left eye. And to give you an idea how difficult, you know, that was for me, how that symbolic message was for me, it really had an effect on us. I mean, it stripped us of any normalcy. It changed our viewpoints on everything. My mother, and a lot of people don't know this either, my mother is a minister.
Hmm.
And this has created a lot of questions for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't really go to church anymore. I mean, she's still spiritual, but we were raised in the church. I was an altar boy. I used to carry the cross down, and we had a strong belief.
Right. Wow. So, and then the third incident.
Yeah, that came in 1969. I was riding at Butternut Basin Ski Resort. Used to have horse racing competitions or children's competitions during the summer, a way to keep the doors open, I guess. And nothing major. It was just a local thing. And I had been asked to ride, and I was in a full run, and my saddle came loose, and my mother and others came out and rescued me, and I was pretty upset about it, and so she gave the horses to Ferris, who lived down the road, to take back to the stables, I rode back in a station wagon with my brother and grandmother. And being upset, they took me out for ice cream. I can't remember exactly what I had or anything, but I know I had fireballs, you know. I think it was a burger or something, and there was a store in there, and I used to like those cinnamon fireballs, so I had one of those, and they were coming back way to the house, off Route 7, which is the main road, actually, through Sheffield, Great Barrington. I was giving my brother the fireball to my right. He was sitting behind the passenger seat, and my grandmother turned around, because don't give it to Matthew, he's too young, he could choke. When she turned around to look at us, she could see all these lights that looked to be in the woods, like almost like spotlights, bright lights in the woods. Today it would look like maybe helicopter lights or floods, but it was very lit up. And the left side of the road kind of rose up off the road a little bit. It was a little higher up. You couldn't really see much, except it was very lit up. The next thing, she could see this what looked like, what she references, looking like a floating strip mall. And the next thing we know, the car actually, and as cliche as it sounds, it did actually stall. And it coasted and went off to the right side of this road. You could hear the stones hitting underneath the car. That's how silent it got. Very spooky. It was like a dead calm. You didn't hear a sound. There was no crickets, no katydids, no birds, nothing. It was just dead silent.
Mm-hmm.
And then, bang, everything erupted. Katydids, crickets. And when I do a conference, I crank it up, because that's how explosive it was. And then we all remember having a different time after that. I remember being in a what looked like a holding cell or a hangar, like almost like an airplane hangar. And I'm not ruling that out. You know, I don't know really where I was, but I was not in a car.
Mm-hmm.
The space that I was in a lot of respects, looked like an airplane hangar. And where I was, if this was a football field, I was, when I was in this area, I was at what would be like a 5-yard line. And ahead of me, and I don't remember seeing it before, early on, but I did remember seeing what looked like a doorway or a light, and there was a figure that stood there. And for whatever reason, I had walked towards it, and I was abruptly grabbed in my left arm, and I was taken down a hallway, which went off to the right. These halls looked very tall to me. As a child, they looked very tall to me. The walkways there were fairly narrow. Then I got, after maybe 20 feet or so, maybe more, but it didn't seem that long, I took a left, and these were sharp corners, and I was brought into a room. And what I saw in there was very different than what a lot of other people describe, but saw looked like an ant, looked like a like an insect type of a. It had a gelatin looking head that was like a goldish brown, and it looked like a combination of maybe a spider or an ant, a genetically tweaked, and it looked intelligent, and it was probably the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
And
I ran out of there. I ran into what looked like a huge intersecting hallway. Again, this was the hallway was probably the size of a basketball, the whole basketball court, stadium seating, everything. And it would look shaped like a Y. There was a hallway that went straight up to the right, another one that went back to the right, and then a huge one that looked bigger and wider that was off to the left. And in between these hallways that formed this V, the rooms bowed outward, almost as if it was meant to be able to handle a lot of traffic. And I was brought back into the room, and you know, Alien Mystery showed this piece coming over me, and I do remember some type of a cage-like thing being put over me, and again, I know how it sounds, but that's what happened, and so I. To validate some of that, and you know, we did have a polygraph test taken about it as well, and I've only taken one. I passed it with a 99.1%. We've got testimony from those at Bigamount Country Club at Jug End and WSBS Radio, and the kids and the parents at Salton School, and J. Allen Hynek gave it a Hynek rating way back when, which was later on. Found by attorney Robert Blechman. And attorney Robert Blechman was my personal attorney who, unknown to me at the time, actually had been working with J. Allen Hynek way back when. And in the 80s, I think he actually became the public relations director for MUFON. And he had been working with, and you probably know this, working with the Parapsychology Society and Muhammad Ramadan. And when my father ran for office, it actually was in office two terms. He had run into Robert. They were both Democrats. And I think this is where we kind of, if there's a word, lucky, this might have been it, where my father was talking to him about the Hudson River Valley case. He had mentioned that to my dad. And my father said, he's talking to my son. So it turns out that Blechman's law firm on Broad Street in Manchester was only a mile and a half from my condo.
Wow.
After work, I would stop by and speak with him and talk with him in his office, and he'd show me pictures of the craft that was taken by a police officer off a bridge. It looked like it was underwater and that sort of thing, and we became friendly, and I trusted him, and we started spending more and more time going over a lot of the particulars, and so he looked into it, and he found these Hynek-rated cases, I guess, or however you look at that, and really took an interest in it, and because of the pillar standing, I guess, is for my father, he really wanted to be able to reference a case that was just outside New York that had what he felt was had some credibility and merit. And with that, he asked if he could, you know, make mention of it, you know, not a front run or anything, but just, you know, it's right outside New York, let's, you know, if it comes up, we'll talk about it or mention it, or. And he really only was really interested in how the wildlife was affected and what we believed was a environmental change. And and our feeling on that. And so he did. On October 2nd, 1992, there was a meeting with the Parapsychology Society, which was held, it might have been in the library, I think it was, at the United Nations, and Stanton Friedman was there, and Bud Hopkins, and our attorney, Robert Buckman, was there. He organized the whole thing, and they talked about a lot of things, Cash Landerman, cases from Mexico, the Greece Ministry, defense, had testimony, and a lot of that's in the black hole. But that, we really thought that was the end of it, to be honest with you. I mean, we didn't talk about it.
Now, did you all get to speak at this meeting, or did he just cover your case?
He just mentioned it on the backside. What it was, and I'm glad you asked that, Cash and Landerman had their vehicle affected by heat or something. I don't really know the case too well, but Blechman really had an interest in the Cash and Landerman case out of Texas. Because we were referencing and discussing what we thought, electromagnetic fields and the environment changing. He took an interest in that in support of the Cash and Landerman. What he had told, what Blechman had said to me, he goes, I'm not even sure that Cash Landerman had graduated high school. As it turned out, they did. But he was looking, and I think that was his way of saying, look, we're looking for some a credible family or a credible person or a pillar in the community that had the same type of thing happen so that we can use that credibility to make Cash Landerman. Our case was only in support of Cash Landerman.
I see.
And so it was only with respect to the environmental change. But what was really interesting and what I think is instrumental in this case is that Blechman, my father, we all stayed in touch for decades.
Cool.
And in 2006, when my dad came to Florida and we talked about doing something with this book project, he was getting ready to retire. He was 56, but we had kept our mouths shut for a long time, and he was kind of grateful for that. So we were always pushing him, let's write a book about it. Let's do it. Let's talk about it. Because he had gotten so much information passed down to him from other people, and Blechman as well. So I've got papers that are all stamped October 5th, October 5th, October 5th, that came back from that meeting. I've got them in my safe. And so with that said, my father thought, well, look, he's got, everyone's seen papers from Stein and, the rest of them, but there were some things that my dad got, Truman letters, we've all seen those, but there must be something that he was given that maybe was different. Maybe he found out something. Maybe he was told something. He was no longer a politician anymore. He was a principal of a school. And he was, at this point, he had some pull. If he wanted to say something on the radio or get on the news or share something or, get some media attention, bang, he made a phone call. But he still, at the same time, was no longer a politician, and he was no longer practicing law. He was a principal. So when he went to write this book, he had all these documents and a lot of papers, and he was still making some inquiries, and so he announced it. And he had written before. He's been published before. And so he went to school to work and got violently sick, and we lost him. And the CDC did come in, as the mayor of Bridgeport was a very good friend of my father's. The CDC did come in, and they found a deadly virus in his air conditioning unit, and that building has been closed and shut down. As far as I know, to this day. I've got the documents on that, too. Garfield School.
Wow. And how did he feel? How did your dad feel about your case and what you guys had experienced?
Oh, he knew. I mean, he talked to Robert Blechman for years.
Mm-hmm.
He was young, visiting us.
So he believed all you all, and he felt it was something mysterious and unusual also.
No, he knew. He knew. He always thought that there, because we live so close to Pratt & Whitney, electric boat, where they made the nuclear submarines, Command Aerospace, which was outside of Windsor, not too far from the Bradley International Airport. It may sound far away, but it's an hour and a half drive. Always thought, between that and the Nike missile sites and all this kind of stuff that was up in the Berkshire Mountains, you'd be surprised what's buried underground, that maybe there was a government connection there.
He
always believed that. And like I said, what happened in 69, the more I think about it, what we saw in 66 and 67 to me seemed much more advanced than what we saw in 69. What I saw in 69 looked like a hangar. Some weird friggin' being that You know, I used to think I can't even talk about it because it sounds so ridiculous, but the more I look into things and the more I see where, you know, what's happening here with, you know, monkeys and chimps and crossbreeding and tweaking, not out of the question that this was just something that was a designer being of some sort, which for all I know could have been made here. I don't know. I just happened to see it. Gut feeling tells me the more and more I look into this and what happened with my father, the documents that he had, I'm almost inclined to believe that maybe he was right. Maybe 69 was more localized than we really would think. And so with that said, we lost him. But what day did we lose him on? The same damn day that our case went to the U.S. When I say went to the U.N., was discussed on the backside, it was a supporting documentation of someone else, but it did go to the U.N. And my father dies on the same day?
Mm-hmm.
Same day.
But years later, right?
Yeah, 14 years later, but only after he was getting ready to write about it.
Hmm.
And so Blechman passed about a year after that, supposedly from natural causes, which I have no reason to doubt that he didn't. But then a doctor who investigated and looked at my brother's wounds and evaluated my son and looked into some other, he died too. He died 8 weeks after going public. He died. Detective White, you know Steve White? Detective Steve White, you ever talk to him?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Alien Mysteries made it look like Steve White was a MUFON investigator. Steve White was a 30-year police officer and an active detective. When he investigated our case, he was an active detective.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me down to get my polygraph test, and he also brought me over to the Knoxville Hypnosis Center because there they did testing.
Mm-hmm.
And my son had been, I was talking about some of the things that my son could do that seemed to be a little higher than coincidental chance when he was tested with schools and when he was tested at the Miami Children's Hospital and through the Hoffman test. He was in the gifted superior range and in school and that sort of thing. So just Steve's like, well, let's bring him over there. You got insurance, have him tested. I'm like, okay. So I did. And Michael Buckner tested my son. And I've got reports from Dr. Michael Buckner. And I've since spoken to the administrative assistant for his wife. And Michael Buckner wrote a report, his findings on what he felt to be my son testing higher than coincidental chance, which is how he got the nickname Chance.
Hmm. And higher than coincidental chance of what?
He would take pieces of paper or my son was actually in a conference room and Michael Buckner was down the hallway in his office, and he's called my son, phone to phone, and say, okay, I've got five cards here, water, whatever, and then there were numbers, and then there were patterns, and then there was, what am I holding down, what do you believe that it is? And my son, just to give you an idea, just in the cards that he was doing, there were five cards which gave it a 16% chance that he would get it right, and he was scoring over 38% at one point, four in a row, which really helped a lot. Then he dropped three or four and got his last one. And he also did that in Lexington, Kentucky, at a conference in Lexington.
So you feel he had some psychic ability that is related to your experience?
There is no doubt in the Miami Children's Hospital, the Hoffman reports, or the Knoxville Hypnosis Center that my son and the schools, that my son doesn't have a gift of some sort.
Hmm. Does he have mysterious incidents or experiences that he's had also?
Well, yeah, there was a time that I don't talk about much because if I say too much, there's not much more to talk about. But I will tell you this, open mind. My son was in his room, and I heard Lori Wagner actually was in the documentary, and we actually talked to her about it too, so it might be out in a couple months, this one particular thing that I don't talk about, screamed at the top of his lungs. I mean, it was just I ran out of my room.
Hmm.
He was sitting up in his bed, and what he had seen looked like a white sheet. Like he referred to it as resembling a white silk sheet that looked to be in his ceiling. And his friend was over from Florida, who was actually just sleeping on a mattress on the floor. And, the two of them were just in awe because they both had this weird thing that they saw in their room. Now, why my son got so scared about that, I don't know, but he felt weird, he felt different, and I keep going back to what happened when I was a child and how this whatever happens around you, your body senses and feels it because it's unfamiliar to it. And I think maybe that combined with seeing something so, I don't like to use the word paranormal, but something that it was just very different that you've never seen before that you know was right there in front of you, and it scared the living daylights out of him. And on top of that, to give you an idea of what his abilities are, I can send you reports from his schools and everything. I mean, he's past gifted. He's in the superior range. He tested in the 127th percentile. Do I think that this has anything to do with what happened to our family? I think it's possible. I don't have another to compare it to. But then again, my ex-wife didn't have this knack, and I certainly can't do what he can do. So it came from somewhere.
Yeah.
But he an exceptional child. We got lucky. Yeah, okay. I can accept that. But I don't know if that's really what I believe. I do believe that there's something to it. I also believe that there's not just something extracted from us, because there were wounds that were just above the thymus gland, and according to our doctor's reports at the Avon Medical Clinic, that it was right near or above or below the thymus gland, which produces the T cells for the body's immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And the two holes he had behind his right ear were almost identical to his chest, and apparently there's a connecting tube of some sort that actually has the brain regulating how much of these T cells are distributed through the body. So that tells me that maybe there's an interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you can only go by what you see. You can only go by the facts. I mean, there was radiation.
Right.
There was radiation readings around our vehicle that were detected and logged.
And this was the SUV, and I think that's probably why Bleckman had an interest, Tom, because in the Cash Landrum case, there was radiation effects also, and then in your SUV, there were effects and electromagnetic effects that they had recorded. Is that correct? And was the SUV part of the third incident?
No, the SUV was actually Brownsburg. That didn't come to 40 years later. But that was where they found it and proved it. Until 2009, and that's what's really strange about this, too. We had nothing happen since the 60s. And then, bang, this happens in Brownsburg during that Kokomo boom, they called it.
Hmm.
My brother was wrapped up in that. But, again, you're right, though. What Bleckman took an interest in was what we referenced and talked about and shared regarding how the environment was affected, how we felt, the difference in change in the room, and, I mean, we would talk about it. I mean, your hair would stand up on your arms. At least my, it was just, it's that strong. And how everything became like a calm and a like almost like a placid, dead calm type of thing.
Mm.
That you can see and feel, but you're, and I go back again to the ELF. You know, there are certain frequencies with ELF that can control people. You know, your mind fires on neurons. You control those neurons. You can put people in a can of, in a sleep state. You can stimulate moods. So I really do believe that that is part or a anomaly of what takes place, whether it's intentional or not. I have a feeling it probably is. But that's what Bleckman was very interested in, was our feeling on that environmental change in support of, like you said, the Cash Landerman, because they had a lot of effects to their vehicle. So you go back to 2009 when this happened with my brother, 40 years later, and that's where, you had that, the Bigelow thing when invested money was one of the first cases in April of 2009 where they were trying to put together this this funded team. And so they came out, and then, of course, things changed, and Chase Bugsy got involved, and all of a sudden no one knew who our paperwork was.
What happened in 2009? What was what that they were investigating?
My brother was coming home from a movie with a friend in Avon and heading back to Brownsburg. And he was just dropped his friend off and was heading across some open fields and back roads. And he saw what looked like a ball about the size of a Volkswagen Bug, I guess is the best way to describe it. It was orange. It looked very cylinder. It looked round. It had what could have been or looked to have a yellow and an orange type of maybe moving color or something. It's hard to say exactly, but it looked like it was a ball of fire, but it was in a sphere. And he saw it what looked like drop or dive behind a house, or maybe it was just the way the road was. You couldn't see it. It went behind the house. And so he followed it. And, you know, to make a long story short, he found himself off the road. He was also working part-time as a private investigator, a fugitive recovery. So he always had his gun on his person. It was no longer on his person. It was on the seat. He was just remembers now getting back into the vehicle. He went to start the vehicle. There was all kinds of damage to the electrical system. They made it
wow.
silly. In Alien Mysteries, it was bouncing around. Didn't do that. Just didn't work. And then his four-wheel drive mechanism was burned out, and it had been there for quite some time. It was about an hour and 32 minutes is what he's come up with, and with the different, you know, clock in the car and so on and so forth. And he remembers a lot of, you know, flashes of this and a flash of that, and you know, being a very grounded and an old man with a good head on his shoulders, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around it and make sense of what you're remembering right now. And so we got back to the house, and you know, my grandmother was staying with him, Marion, who was with us in 1969, and she cared for him, and his son was there as well. And the next morning, he actually called me, and I said, you know what, just call, you know, just report it. You have to. It is what it is. And then later on, we had heard all these sightings and the Kokomo, they called it the Kokomo Bloom, where a lot of people are having sightings too. So he got lucky, and, you know, some of that Bigelow Bass thing came out at first and talked with him. And then, of course, there was a changing of the guards back then due to funding or whatever. I don't want to get into that. But you probably know more about that than I do. And then some other people came out. And these two different teams came out. First, it was the Star team that was funded through the Bass money. And then there was a changing of the guards. And the second team came out that was under Chase Klutzke. And so they were looking at the vehicle, and they found that the compass would spin on the roof, and there was what they called radioactive hot spots. And when I see you, I'll bring those emails that came from the officer himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were radiation there. And it was only around the back primarily. The magnetic fields kind of went from the back door around like a horseshoe of the vehicle. The magnetic fields faded fairly quickly. From what I understand, the radiation was still on the ground, even years later.
Wow. Did he feel during that event that he had any missing time, or he was taken elsewhere?
Yeah, no, he remembers. He remembers a lot. He remembers, you know, much like what happened in Sheffield, and it's hard for him to really talk about it, but he's been doing better with it. I would say that what he remembers is what we remember, which aside from this insect type of creature or being or spider, whatever it was, you know, I don't know if what we saw, people, you know, clone or jump on that term graves. This didn't look like what you see. This didn't have that whole look. This, what we saw looked very human, but very odd human. You know, a terrible overbite, not that pointed chin. It was almost like a very bad overbite, a small chin. It was just, they looked somewhat human. I mean, just cross an oriental with a typical gray, and maybe you got something close. That's kind of what it looked like, or what we saw, and that's what Matthew references from 2009.
Wow.
And just you know, odd. You know, maybe like a mongoloid, like a oriental mongoloid.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And so we, you know, we try to, you know, we sketch things, and we have people work with us, and we've drawn things as children, and we have artists try to go over them with us and to depict what we saw and be honest about it.
Right.
But,
so, and it sounds like, unfortunately, after all of these years, you're really at a loss as to the nature of what might have happened, whether it was something, you know, local or not.
Well, I think that, yeah, you know, how can I really say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not an expert on anything. What I can tell you is what we saw in 66 and 67, that was from off-world. I can tell you that right now. That was off-world. That was not built here. The way that it moved, what we saw, that was not manufactured here. What happened in 69 was a much larger vessel. What we saw did not look anything like what we saw in 66 or 67 with respect to the interior. It didn't have that. It was very left-right, large open bays. It was different. What we 66 and 67 was the hallway wrapped around like a question mark. It was very quiet, very still. There was a a deep feel, like a rhythmic type of feel to it. There was a knocking sound, like that of maybe an MRI machine to some degree. I was late in the MRI, and I hear that, you know, knocking a little bit. 69 just was completely different. It was kind of harsh, rushed, orchestrated, whereas what happened before, it was almost like a field trip or an indoctrination of some sort. I don't remember that. But I remember that we were not as scared, and it didn't feel, it just felt so different. And so, yeah, I think 69 could have, I'm open to suggestions of 69, I really am.
Mm-hmm. And so it's only been, even though it was so many years ago that those initial experiences had happened, it seems it's only been lately that you've really been out there talking about it more.
I don't really know if that's true.
Yeah?
I've been talking about this since we went to school.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking about this since fourth grade. I've been talking about this in the 80s with Blechman. My mother actually had a radio show where we talked about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My mother was a radio host on WKZE.
Mm-hmm.
But with my father running for office and that sort of thing, no, it being professionals and... And, you know, I own a business. I own Miami Models in South Beach. I mean, my brother's a professional. My father being an attorney, you know, you certainly don't want to run around shooting your mouth off about it. Certainly back then had a big rolling of the eyes about it, and it certainly wasn't going to help your career. So why talk about it? But as far as once my father died on the same day, that's when the family got together and said, you know what, this is beyond... The only way to really get our point out there is to make a stand. You know, what happened is just wrong. And what to go back on that too. My father has a proclamation. He has a local holiday dedicated to him. Our family has a holiday in their honor. October 6th is a localized, recognized holiday. It's a proclamation in Connecticut that makes that day a remembrance day of my father. There is also a bench in the city green dedicated to our family in Milford.
Wow.
So my mother, mostly my mother, feels that, well, we don't want to tarnish the legacy my father has, but at the same time, being that he passed suddenly and mysteriously under questionable circumstances on the same day, that day of October 2nd, hopefully maybe his legacy, his pillar standing, what he's contributed to the city, and what our family has contributed to the city of Bridgeport and New Haven, that hopefully that will filter over to this phenomenon, to ufology, and offer or bring a little bit of that merit and value and pillar standing that my father worked so hard to gain for our family. Hopefully some of that will triple over, not the other way around. And my mother's concerned about that. You know, a lot of people still to this day, you know, act like this is more for entertainment purposes. My father died for this. You know, we know what we saw. We passed polygraph tests. There's evidence. There's trace evidence of this. This is not a story. I'm not writing a book. I'm not selling anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this happened. And I think our case has a lot of value, and I think now that it's getting some mainstream attention, I'm hoping that the more, and I encourage people to look into it, I encourage people to investigate it and look closely. The more you look at this, the more you're going to find that there is a lot here, and probably more than I'm even aware of. When I come to New Mexico, I'll be happy to bring copies of what I have. If you want to sit down with me for an hour, I'll bring it with me.
No, that's great. I mean, certainly the show is about getting information to the audience, and I think you've been able to go over a lot of information here about the main events that had happened, and I think people are going to find it extremely interesting. And, of course, they can go and find more information, including a lot of the documents you're talking about and some videos of you speaking with different reporters over the years at Tom Reed, TOMREED.info, not .com, it's .info, to find out more. And is there any other website, or is that the best place for people to go to?
The other spot, you could go to Roswell under lectures. You can,
okay.
There's a really good bio there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be there in 2014, and hopefully, again, I look forward to talking to you there, and I'll bring what I can, and I'll make copies for you, and you can, you know, do what you, if you feel that there's a, you know, an interest in them, feel free to share them.
Okay, great.
On my website, because a lot of these, I think, until I really know what they mean or what they say. I mean, I've got stuff here from, like I said, from the Ministry of Defense, the Pentagon.
Wow.
I'm not, like, to give you an idea. There's one right here from the Greece Ministry of Defense, NATO's General Staff, and they talk about, you know, this, you know, the UFOs being a threat. You know, the Pentagon has. I mean, I'll scan these and send them to you. I mean, I don't know if you've seen these before. I don't know anyone else who has these, but these were actually in my father's closet when he passed. I took one of his leather satchels, and it was packed with information.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see those, and certainly, and I think you mentioned before, but just for the listeners, Tom Reed and I will both be at Roswell this summer over the July 4th weekend, speaking and having a table, so you can come say hi to both of us, and then if you're interested in this case, and I'm sure a lot of you will be, you can come visit with Tom as well.
Thank you. Is there anything that you might have a question or two on before we cut this off, or anything that might...
I don't know right now. Really, I think you've gone over a lot. I asked some of the questions that I had, but like you said, I think what's great about this case is the physical evidence, which a lot of cases don't have, and it's just so mysterious. And I think what's great also is your attitude about it, and that... you certainly aren't jumping to any assumptions that you're not quite sure what had happened to you in many of these incidents.
You know, if I have 1 second here.
Definitely.
There are two things. I had to give in a lot of the information about the UN, the talks, and the stuff my father had, the papers, documents, tangibles, to a writer that was actually working in conjunction with Discovery Channel in Canada. And we were a go to pull the trigger on a book. It was when we were really about to, you know, had my attorney working on everything. And he bailed at the last minute after looking at all these documents. He didn't feel at it. In his words, it's not that I'm scared, but I just don't think I need to take that chance. That's how powerful these documents were.
Wow.
And also, I know. And I have had, and if you listen to the interview with Evan West, the reporter from the Indianapolis Monthly Magazine, where he was on WIBC, Fox FM, he will even tell you, and it's on that recording, where he was actually followed by the FBI when he was interviewing us.
Oh, really?
Yeah, listen to WBIC. It's on my link. That didn't come from me. I had no idea he even said that.
Uh-huh.
By the FBI. And I have had FBI in my house. I had someone come June 6th, sit me down on my front steps in my own home, deny me access inside my home, ask me questions if I'm traveling internationally, if I'm savvy with computers, see a badge in my face, the whole bit. And it was part of a Homeland Security. It was part of a division called CRAWL and Key Point Government Solutions. So there's something chill happening. And so when I get asked a lot of, what do you think? Well, there's only one common denominator. So do I jump on it? or do I back away and just say it's a coincidence? But at the same time, you know, my brother and I have had these conversations repeatedly. And the one thing we will agree on is there is a denial. I mean, there's a danger in denial. And so for us just to brush it off, chalk it up for, you know, just another coincidence, I think we're at the point now where we're starting to say, look, you know, they have common threads, and that's what we need to look at.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much. I think you're completely right, and that's the hard part, I think, with a lot of people is just kind of looking at the facts and then sticking to what we know, because like you said, there are commonalities, and that's where conclusions can be drawn, as opposed to making assumptions and, you know, holding fast to suspicions as opposed to holding on to the facts and connecting those dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we are out of time. There is so much to this case. It's been a lot of fun. And, of course, yeah, if you want to send me those documents, that'd be great. We'll see each other in early July. And certainly maybe we can have you back on the show then later in the summer, and I'll update the audience or write more and let them know more about, you know, what we talk about and look at in July. But it's been great to have you on the show and to have you share these experiences. And I think people will agree with me that I agree with you that, you know, sharing this information, well, it's probably therapeutic for you all, but it's not helpful to suppress these sort of memories. It seems it's much more healthy, and I think that's proven. It's much more healthy to talk about them and to try to figure things out.
Absolutely, and I'm going to prove one way or another that my father didn't die for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you all the best, and if there's anything I can do, let me know, and we'll continue to stay in touch, and thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me, and I'll see you in July.
All right, see you soon.
Good night, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Like we talked about, remember you can go to Tom Reed Info, that is Tom, T-O-M, Reed.info, to look up some more information about this case. Like I had mentioned earlier, you could go to our website, openminds.tv, and put in United Nations, and you'll find a lot more information about the United Nations and that decision that they had made that Tom Reed was talking about. But a really interesting case. So definitely go to tomreed.info. So he talked about getting a polygraph test and some of the electromagnetic effects on the car. And if you go to case info on his website, you'll see a lot of the documents that he posted there. So it's always exciting when there is physical evidence related to these things. And otherwise, all of the UFO stories I talked about earlier can be found at openminds.tv. I also want to thank a couple people out there. I want to thank Angel and Alan from Skywatchers Radio, who had me on. You know, Angel, also a.k.a. The Jackal, runs PSN Radio, where they've been playing Open Minds Radio. You might be listening to PSN right now, to the show. So I want to thank Angel. That's really cool. And then this weekend, I was also on, Jason and I were both on his show, the Skywatchers show, last week, so you can go check that out. But then this weekend, I was on Myth or Realities, which is a Las Vegas radio show that is typically ran by Alan Palmer, who is the director of the Museum for Atomic Testing, Nuclear Atomic Testing Museum out there in Las Vegas. And he had me on again this weekend, but then we talked about Clinton and a lot of cool stuff, but there was actually a guest host, Mark Hal Patton, and you might know him because he's, if you're a fan of the TV show Pawn Stars, because he's one of the historians that is on Pawn Stars a lot. He's a guy that wears, always wearing a hat, and he's got a big beard, so I don't know, I love that show because I'm really into history and stuff, and so I was really excited to talk to him, a great guy. So that was a lot of fun. So I want to thank the National Atomic Testing Museum, which sponsors the radio show Myth or Realities, for having me on. That was a lot of fun. So other things to check out, of course, like I said, openminds.tv is where you can find the news. Also, last week we had a new Spacing Out, so you can check that out on our YouTube. Don't forget to check us out on all of the top social networking apps. We are on Twitter at OpenMindsTV and on Facebook at Open Minds Radio and Open Minds Magazine. You can also find me personally on Twitter at AstroATR. That stands for Alejandro T. Rojas, AstroATR. And Jason is at AceCentric. And you can find us both on Facebook just by looking up our names, Alejandro Rojas or Jason McClellan. Also, thank you very much to the artist who created our music, Caleb Hanks. He has made the custom opening music, and we have also been playing songs from his EP, The Clerk Chronicles, at the end of the show. And today we're going to be playing a song called The Watcher. Just Google The Clerk Chronicles to download the EP for free, and it's well worth it. I find myself listening to it quite often. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back with another great show next week. So until then, adios muchachos.
Yeah.